Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. For the first time in almost 2 years, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld spent the night in Iraq. Previously, he made only day trips there because of security concerns. Rumsfeld's symbolic gesture came as he announced that U.S. troops may soon be leaving Iraq.
These adjustments will reduce U.S. forces in Iraq by the spring of 2006, below the high, the current high of roughly 160,000 during the election period when it was bulked up, and also below the 138,000 baseline that had existed prior to the most recent election.
It's not clear exactly how many troops might be withdrawn in total, and Bush administration officials maintain that will depend largely on how well Iraqi forces assume control. We're joined on the line now by Josh White. He's the Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post. Josh, we've heard suggestions from Bush administration officials before about a possible troop drawdown. What's the significance of Secretary Rumsfeld's announcement now?
Well, the significance is clearly that the United States wants to move toward the transition that Congress has essentially asked for, that they want Iraqi security forces to start taking more control of the security of Iraq. They want the U.S. forces to start taking a backup or supporting role. This is part of that transition. Now, it's just a first step. It means essentially that instead of sending two brigades of combat troops into Iraq at the next rotation, they are instead going to hold one of those brigades back in Kuwait on a training mission so that they can be used if necessary, and then they're going to essentially leave a large number of people at home in the United States that would have deployed in, and instead are sending a group of trainers to help build those Iraqi forces.
So some combat troops might be leaving, but there will essentially be an increase in the number of U.S. troops who will be there to train the Iraqi military.
There will be more trainers. Essentially, what is happening is they're bringing out, as part of the normal rotation, they're bringing out combat troops and instead are sending in some non-commissioned officers and officers to help train the Iraqis. It will be a slight decrease in the overall number of U.S. forces there. They announced today out of the Pentagon it would be about 7,000 troops. I've heard as many as possibly 9,000 troops in terms of a reduction. But it still does leave roughly 130,000 troops there. The plan at this point is to reevaluate this as time goes forward and possibly reduce more significantly by the end of the year, the end of 2006.
Now, we've heard the White House say in the past that any decision on a troop withdrawal would be condition-based, based on what exactly is happening on the ground in Iraq. Why this troop reduction now? Are the conditions suggesting that this is the time?
Well, at this point, we've definitely seen an increase in the number of Iraqi security forces, and according to the Pentagon, the quality, the capabilities of those forces have been increasing as well, as you would expect. As time goes on, they become more competent, they get more into the fight, they're able to take more of a leadership role in those activities. However, the move signals that really it's a small step at this point. The Iraqi security forces as a whole are not ready to lead this fight against the insurgency. But this is the direction that they've been wanting to move in for some time. It's a direction that I think we'll see as we move forward more of. As U.S. forces start to pull back, you'll see more Iraqi forces stepping into the fight. Does it mean that the insurgency is going away? Does it mean that the insurgency is weaker? I don't think that specifically it means that anyone thinks that this insurgency is dying down. I think it's more an indication of the capabilities of the Iraqi forces on the ground.
Mm-hmm. What about the question of, though, does it mean that the increasing criticism and lack of public support for the war in Iraq may be pushing the administration a bit?
Well, it's very possible that that's the case. We've heard a number of members of Congress, senators on the Armed Services Committee, calling for these deliberate, cautious withdrawals. We've certainly heard other congressmen say that we should pull out immediately, pull everyone out. I think generally, however, people want the transition to the Iraqi forces, and this is a way to do it. Certainly, the pressure because of the dropping of popularity of the war, the increased concern over having U.S. forces there, I'm sure that plays a role as well.
Even with these reductions, there's still a significant troop level in Iraq, U.S. troop level in Iraq. Is there any indication that the U.S. might be considering a permanent military base there as an option for the future?
Well, it's unclear exactly what those plans are. Certainly, there will be discussions of that type. The U.S. military has indicated it does not want a permanent or long-term presence of this nature in the 130 to 100,000 range. Is it a possibility that they would discuss permanent bases there? I'm sure that's something that will come up in the future. The leaders in the Kurdish area of the country in the north, or Kurdistan, have indicated a desire to have U.S. bases in that region. I'm sure that's something that will come up. I mean, the other thing to keep in mind is at this pace and the way things are going, U.S. forces are probably going to be there in some capacity for the indefinite future.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair visited Iraq recently as well. Were there any indications that there might be a reduction in British troops?
Well, I think all of the coalition members are discussing plans to try to reduce the number of troops there. Certainly in terms of discussing how the coalition works, as the U.S. begins to draw down its forces, the allies who came in with the United States are certainly going to look to do the same. Poland, for example, has been discussing that sort of move. We've seen a number of other countries reduce their forces, especially as we approach the new year. It's also part of the natural progression. As things improve, as the Iraqi security forces are able to take over, you're going to see a reduction in every country's support.
Josh, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Josh White is a Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post. And this note about a story we've been following. Today, the National Archives released a memo written by Supreme Court nominee Judge Samuel Alito saying that Roe v. Wade, the landmark ruling legalizing abortion, should be overturned. In the memo, which Judge Alito wrote while serving in the Reagan administration, he outlines a step-by-step legal strategy for dismantling abortion rights. In the introduction to this memo, Charles Freed, a Reagan administration solicitor general, wrote at the time, quote, "I need hardly say how sensitive this material is and ask that it have no wider circulation." The memo is expected to stir controversy at Alito's upcoming nomination hearing scheduled to begin January 9th. It's been months since the punishing winds and waters of Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast, but people throughout the region are still feeling its effects and reflecting on it this holiday season. Providence Church is located in East Carroll Parish, Louisiana, on the banks of the Mississippi River. Several years ago, the parish was named the poorest place in America. Yet when Katrina struck, the people there opened their hearts and homes to evacuees from New Orleans. Reverend Don Boyette is pastor of Providence Church. We spoke to him after Katrina hit, and he opened the church as a shelter for several hundred evacuees. Today, the shelter's closed. Many of the evacuees have returned home or have found other permanent housing. And Reverend Boyette, your community came together to help survivors after Hurricane Ivan in 2004. How was this experience different?
We thought we were ready for the next big catastrophe, and then Katrina comes, and I mean changes everything. And about the first week that we opened as a shelter, we were not ready by any means. These folks had nothing. I mean nothing, and no way to get anything because their banks were destroyed or closed. And so about the first week, gosh, we were just about to kill each other. I mean the workers, the volunteers, because we just weren't ready for that kind of, you know, need. But once we settled in and we got a routine going and mellowed out, we began to see how wonderful the opportunity was that God had given us. And so I watched the community come together once again. And we've gotten some pretty bad publicity over the years, our community has. And so watching this community that seems to have been forgotten come together like that certainly has been a great blessing.
Is there one particular story there, or one particular family that stands out in your mind?
I was telling someone earlier, there were so many stories that could be made out of this that finding one that stands out is difficult. I do recall the Mays family that stayed here several weeks after all the shelters were closed, they just stayed, and their husband, the patriarch of the family, would go to New Orleans each weekend to work on their home. They were flooded out, but the structure was still there. So he'd go each weekend and repair some of the damage, gut out the house, and start over. And they would stay here and worship with us each Sunday. So we grew close to that family. It was a family of about 13, counting the immediate and the extended family. But They had a home in Lake Providence, but they would worship with us, and beautiful people. I mean, just extraordinary people. It was a black family, and they were just a vital part of our community and our church for a while, and we keep in touch. We take all the information that we can on each person that comes into the shelter, and we are therefore able to keep in touch with these folks to find out how they're doing, to help them if they need help, you know, in getting started again. So, you know, there were so many families. Perlina Clark is a lady who lost everything. I mean, just wiped out and just never went back to New Orleans. She lives here now with us as a vital part of our community and a beautiful person. And several, now there are still evacuees living here in homes, staying with some family, but there are no shelters now as far as a group of people together.
Do you know how many evacuees might still be located there?
Some, probably 100, 150 would still be in the city. We were able to get all the ones in our shelter. We sent them to their families in other parts of the nation. Because of the great generosity of the whole nation, really, and around the world, because of the piece that you did, the program that you did, and the BBC did also something that people from around the world were giving.
How do you think you're going to be talking about this in your holiday message this weekend?
Dealing with the area of giving, since Christmas to us is a time of giving. More importantly than even receiving, and we're counting our blessings, how blessed we are. It shows that when we would talk to these dozens of families to their loss, we realized how blessed we are, and that it is in giving that we are blessed. We call it the law of reciprocity, or the law of sowing and reaping. As we give, we reap. And we give according to, we reap according to how we give. And, you know, that message, we've been preaching a long time in our fellowship and in our community. We see the impact and effect of it. So really we'll be talking a lot about giving, which is what Christmas is all about. You know, God giving his son and us in return giving our lives to him to use to help other people, to make the world a better place to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll pretty well be the theme. It's usually that at Christmas, but now it's almost show and tell, you know.
Right. I was going to say, how is it different this year?
We can put pictures with the words. We can talk about the Mays family. We can talk about those families that were here and that we could see and touch and hug and encourage. And we can, it's like putting a picture with words.
Reverend Boyette, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh my goodness, been my pleasure.
Reverend Don Boyette is pastor at Providence Church in Providence, Louisiana. Just ahead, a retail giant in Boston puts up its holiday window displays for the last time. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Well, for those still procrastinating, the pressure is on. With less than 2 shopping days until Christmas, retail industry analysts expect shoppers to flood stores today through early tomorrow afternoon. And with Christmas on a Sunday this year and Hanukkah starting the next day, Monday is expected to be a very busy shopping day. But after this year, one holiday shopping tradition will become another faded Yuletide memory. Here and Now producer Kevin Sullivan takes us to a Boston landmark, the Filene's Department Store, whose legendary holiday window displays have delighted children for generations.
White lights and Christmas greenery cheer the cobblestone walkways in Boston's downtown crossing. As shoppers search for last-minute deals, and in the midst of all this hubbub, a holiday treasure beckons.
Oh, look at the gingerbread man!
Gingerbread man.
Is that Santa Claus?
The girls are marveling at Filene's Department Store's holiday windows, a must-see for many Bostonians. This year's window is based on a 1997 children's book.
Every single thing's moving!
Filene's general manager, Steve Myers.
There's a great story called All of the Reindeer, which is about a small dog who, in listening to Christmas carols, when he hears all the other reindeer the song, thinks they're saying all of the other reindeer. And, of course, the dog's name is Olive.
Like a cup of hot cocoa on a blustery day, the windows are a true winter treat.
That's Santa Claus.
And that's the dog.
That's the dog.
And that's the elves.
And with a penguin.
That's a penguin. And that's the dog.
For about 40 years, kids have jostled from one window to the next, anxious to watch a Yuletide story unfold.
Well, I grew up in Boston. I was born and raised here, and I always came to Filene's at Christmas.
Beautiful. Beautiful. It's always nice. A little different than last year, but it's nice.
But that tradition is about to come to an end. This summer, Federated Department Stores acquired Filene's. As part of the deal, Filene's flagship store in downtown Boston will close next year, and the historic 1912 building will be sold.
Filene's is a Boston tradition, and I think it's very sad that it's, you know, going to disappear, and it's a part of the Boston scene, and I think it's important to see a little bit of that before it disappears.
I think it's nice to come in town and have them just walk around and see how things are so different in other parts of our state, you know, and it's our tradition.
What was it like when you were a kid?
It's absolutely beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. I mean, they had the Santa Claus with the, you know, the beard and the whole nine yards and the little dogs and the little children. It was really nice.
Lincoln Filene Ladd says his family always made Christmas a special time. His grandfather was one of two brothers who helped build the Filene's empire, started by their father.
It was in the late 30s. We were at the store the day before Christmas, and after the store closed, my grandfather went down and stood by the door through which all the employees left, and he shook hands with each one of them, called most of them by name, as I remember. He knew them, wished them a Merry Christmas, and to this day, I remember kind of a caring atmosphere. This was not something which was a mere formality. It was something that both my grandfather and the people who worked with him enjoyed and looked forward to.
Ladd is a 79-year-old retired English professor from Maine. None of his family has ties to Filene's anymore, but he still has a special fondness for the store.
We decided that we would buy presents for all of our Filene family members for this Christmas, make sure that they were all packed in Filene boxes.
What was it like going through the store for the last time?
Well, it was sad, very frankly. We had always assumed that Filene's would be there, and suddenly we knew that it wasn't going to be. Not just the name, which is, of course, my name, I'm Lincoln Filene Ladd, but the store that my grandfather had been associated with most of his life, the actual store, which was built in 1912, is not going to be a Filene's anymore. We will miss it.
Filene's downtown building with its decorative cornices was once a grand dam of Boston commerce, and it's a reminder of a time when shopping was an event. Again, store manager Steve Myers.
The building, if you look at the exterior of it, is just a classic. It's a John Burnham design architecturally, and it is a landmark. When you see the crystal chandeliers and whatever else and the high ceilings, it is certainly goes back to those worlds. So many of the departments are very much like they were.
Boston isn't the only city to lose its local department store. Federated is also closing Marshall Field in Chicago and Kauffman's in Pittsburgh, among others. There have been several bids to buy the Filene's building for a reported $130 million. But Ladd says no matter who buys the building, it'll never be the same.
Represents one of the last of the stores started by somebody who really cared about people. And my grandfather did. He really cared about the quality of what he sold. And I don't know whether that tradition exists today or not, but that certainly will be missed by me.
It's extremely nostalgic, and I can't say that it's not kind of gut-wrenching. It really kind of hasn't hit home yet, because it's not here yet, We have associates up in the our store that waited on these people's grandchildren, their children, every right down the generations have shopped here in this store. So it's very nostalgic.
And that's a reindeer eating hot chocolate, drinking hot chocolate.
And that's the
sleigh.
And
that's the, I don't know.
That was Here and Now producer Kevin Sullivan from Filene's flagship department store in Boston's downtown crossing. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim McKay, speaking to you live at this moment from ABC headquarters, just outside the Olympic Village in Munich, West Germany.
ABC sportscaster Jim McKay on September 5th, 1972, with one of the first reports on what would turn out to be the most tragic day in Olympic history. Early that morning, Arab terrorists raided the Israeli quarters in the Olympic Village, taking several athletes hostage. Although the games continued that day, they were eventually suspended later that afternoon. In the end, 11 Israeli athletes, 5 of the terrorists, and 1 German police officer died in a shootout at the airport. The games resumed after a memorial service at the Olympic Stadium. Those events echo again today as the new Steven Spielberg film Munich opens. Israeli officials dispute the premise of the film, which is based on a book that says Israel assassinated Palestinians who had alleged ties to the murders in Munich. Today, though, we look back at the Munich Olympics with marathon runner Kenny Moore, who was a member of the U.S. track team at the time. Moore and fellow marathoner Frank Shorter were asleep in the Olympic Village when the hostage crisis began.
Frank heard something when he sounded like a door slam, but it awakened him enough to make him realize that that wasn't a normal thing at that hour. It was about 4:45 in the morning. And he felt later that that was a gunshot when he put things together. A few minutes later, there was a pounding on the track coach's door downstairs on the first floor. And our track coach, Bill Bowerman, opened it. And before him, there was an Israeli race walker, Shaul Ladani. He said, "Can I come in? Can I stay here?" And Bill said, "Well, what for?" And he said, "The Arabs are in our building." And Bill said, "Well, tell them you get out." And Ladani said, "They've shot some of our people. I got out through a window." And then that barman said later that changed the whole complexion. And he grabbed Ladani and drew him into the safety of the room, sat down and got out of him what he knew. He had escaped when someone had started screaming, "Get out and get out." And all the Israelis they all had military training. They all responded to orders very well. A lot of people got out when they first attacked the building. And so when Bill called our American embassy, said he didn't know what the situation quite was, but that across the street from us, the armed Arabs had moved into the Israeli quarters, and that we had Jewish kids in the building. He listed a bunch of them. Mark Spitz was one. Said they needed security, and 30 minutes later, there were Marines in the entrance of the U.S. buildings and in the halls, and Bowerman was later reprimanded for that, for bringing Marines in. But by that time, everybody knew he'd done the right thing.
The peace of what would have been called the Serene Olympics was shattered just before dawn this morning, about 5 o'clock, when Arab terrorists, armed with submachine guns, faces blackened, climbed the fence, went to the headquarters of the Israeli team and immediately killed one man. They've been holding 14 others hostage since then, and the latest report is that one more has been killed.
It's interesting to look back and realize that And until then, and I was 28. That was my 29th year on Earth. I had believed the Olympics immune somehow to the threats of the larger world. And it was an illusion. It was the highest degree of wishful thinking. But it had been a hell of a strong illusion, and it just rocked me personally to have that shattered. And I remember sharing that feeling with Steve Prefontaine, also on the team. Just remember him raging about the blindness of the terrorists at what he felt was just their sheer malignant gall to come in here, and because these were our games, he said. Anybody who would murder us for some demented cause, no matter what it was, just proves that he can't understand what it is that we do.
Now, we've just gotten the final word. You know, when I was a kid, my father used to say, our greatest hopes and our worst fears are seldom realized. Our worst fears have been realized tonight. They have now said that there were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. 9 were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
After the Israelis were killed, the reporters had gathered around the locked outer gates of the airport. And about 11 in the evening, someone with Olympic insignia, no one really knows who, came to the fence and shouted, all are saved, all are saved. And so that was the word that went around the world. The German government spokesman repeated it to everybody. The newspapers repeated it, printed it. We saw papers, the early editions. And it was only about 2 a.m. that the German armed forces returned with the truth. I remember feeling, what's the use? A friend of mine, Joel Sermans, a Dutch 5,000-meter runner, wonderfully moral man, went home without competing, even before they announced that next day that the games would continue, because he said, hey, if you throw a party and a gunman comes in and murder a dozen guests, you don't break out another keg and go on with the party. And Bill Bauerman would never be more eloquent than what he was in conveying the necessity that games go on. I remember him saying from the Olympics, what was it, from 776 BC to 393 AD, which is like 1,200 years, Olympians laid down their arms to take part in the games. They knew there's more honor in outrunning a man and then killing him. And so one by one, with time and reminders like that, we came one by one to really not only to see the truth in that, but to feel it, a part of it. I remember Frank saying later, Frank Shorter, the day that we watched as the hostages were held and the day off for the memorial service, we went through the stages humans go through in stress. We went from denial to anger to grief and to resolve. And then we had to decide kind of what to do with that resolve. Frank was the eloquent one then. He said, we have to spread the word by performance that barbarism only makes Olympians stronger. We have to say, this is as scared as I get. And let's go run.
Kenny Moore finished fourth in the Munich Marathon. His roommate, Frank Shorter, won the gold. Moore is writing a book about the coach of the U.S. track team at the Munich Games, Bill Bauerman. The film Munich, which tells the story of what happened after the 1972 Olympics ended, opens today. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Thank you.
of dancers, Mikhail Baryshnikov, has written, quote, "Exceptional dancers are also exceptional people, people with an attitude toward life, a kind of quest, and an internal quality." Well, our next guest exemplifies that. He's one of the top ballet dancers in the world. He's also one of the rare students at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government to be admitted to a master's program without having a bachelor's degree. 38-year-old Damian Wetzel is a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet, and we reached him at the studios of the Boston Ballet, where he's been performing the Nutcracker as a guest artist. Welcome, Damian.
Hello.
We should note we are speaking to you by telephone, even though you're just down the road from us in Boston, because everyone here is either sick or recovering from illness, and we didn't want you to get ill as well.
Well, I appreciate the foresight. That's great. Thank you.
Can you tell me what kind of subjects are you studying at the Kennedy School?
Well, I'm taking a full course load plus one, and everything from statistics to statecraft. I'm trying to kind of make up for some lost time education-wise. My career choice sort of precluded my actually getting a traditional college education, but I was lucky enough to grow up in a fairly academic household. My father was a professor, and my mother worked for UNICEF, and I was always intended to go to college. And the Kennedy School program, it's a mid-career master's in public administration program, which is just a wonderful thing that brings together people from all around the world trying to do some good.
Seems very far away from a career as a dancer.
It is and it isn't. You know, it turns out dancers are, you know, we have a certain discipline that comes with the territory, and going back to school was much more kind of in line with that than I expected. Once I got in the swing of it, it felt very familiar to me as far as the workload and just trying to, you know, to do a job well, even though it was learning as opposed to performing. Mm.
You, as we said, you're 38 years old. Dancer's life is pretty short. What do you think you'll do with this master's in public administration?
Well, I mean, actually, that's the question I'm avoiding right now, because I'm trying to keep it as general as possible until this was, I mean, the way I look at it, this was all about opening up opportunities for myself. As a dancer of who I've been lucky enough to have such a wonderful career in the dance, I've choreographed, I teach, I run a school already. I mean, there's some very set career paths as a dancer, but this was all about trying to break out of that and perhaps go into the larger world of culture in America in general. I mean, this certainly is preparing me for something along those lines, for working for on behalf of Ambassador of Culture instead of just ballet, for instance.
You grew up in the Boston area, and then you headed to New York. A friend of the radio station has told us a story about when you were young, you stood out for taking both of the pre-ballet classes at a local dance studio. What was it about ballet that attracted you? I mean, it's tough to be, I think, a little boy who wants to dance in this country.
Well, that's a hilarious story, because if I'm understanding correctly, we're actually talking about me when I was 4 or 5 years old. Which is really funny, because I don't really remember exactly taking both or whatever, but I'm sure I did. I mean, it kind of goes with the territory. It appears that, you know, I take a full course load plus one. I remember that school. I have one brother, an older brother, and we took everything. We had music lessons. We had language lessons. We had, you know, all kinds of different things. And ballet was one of the things that we were exposed to. And it just sort of clicked with me to some extent. I mean, at that age, I think it was much more about just sort of music, I guess. I don't even remember whether it was dancing. When I was 7, I moved to the Boston Ballet School, where I speak to you from now. And that was an opportunity to get on stage. And I think that was sort of the hook. Once a year, I'd be in the Nutcracker, and then I started being in a few more things. I was always standing around in the back holding an umbrella in Swan Lake or something, you know, watching all this go on. And I enjoyed that enough to keep me interested in the dancing until the dancing itself took over as the primary interest, which was probably around 11, I guess. By the time I was 12, I was quite sure I was going to be a professional dancer.
Wow. And it must not have been easy, though, especially to be a young male.
No, there were certainly, you know, there was a battle for hearts and minds in junior high, absolutely.
Right.
And, you know, I think I came through it okay. It's very backbone building, I would say.
And what do you think about that Baryshnikov quote, that exceptional dancers have this kind of quest and internal quality? Would you agree with that?
I like Einstein's better. Dancers are the athletes of God. I like that.
That's very nice.
Good one. Yeah.
Well, Damian, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure speaking with you, Deborah.
Damian Wetzel is a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now.
Well, my God called me this morning.
Hello.
I said, my God called me this morning.
Just a little while.
75 years ago, Jubilee singing was the rap of gospel music. It was hugely popular, a free-form style of singing that pushed the boundaries of gospel, and it's still being sung today.
How sweet the voice did sound, it sounded like a
beep, 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 and all the angels waved as if from heaven coming down.
But then I stopped.
Jubilee singing evolved in the 1930s, when singers began mixing popular harmonies, syncopations, even social commentary, into the somber hymns of the day. Well, some of those old-time sounds are being kept alive by the Silver Leaf Gospel Singers of Roxbury, Massachusetts. The group was formed in 1945 by Deacon Randy Green, who grew up singing in the churches and cotton fields of segregated Alabama. Earlier this year, Here and Now's Lynn Menegon sat down with Deacon Randy, as he likes to be called, and found a sprightly 83-year-old with a mission.
The demons are screaming just a little while. Then I saw that long, tall liar.
Hello.
You know, I can do just about anything I want to do with my voice. And I just feel that is nothing but a blessing from God because of the fact at my age, He didn't have to do it for me, but He did. I was the first promoter for gospel music in the greater Boston area. Back in those years, the ticket prices was a dollar and a quarter advance, dollar and a half at the door. And it took a lot of work and a lot of people to try to make any money to pay the groups and have a little money left for yourself. And I got tired of, that type of thing. So then I said, well, I'll put that energy into our own group. And it has paid off.
Lord, so many years, I lived in sin, so many times, all astray. But I know Jesus said He knows, said He will lead on one day.
I thought of the name Silver Leaf because I felt that good silver shines. And even though silver sometimes tarnish, but if you take it and rub it and polish it up a little bit, it comes back to its original shine. And then the word leaf, I've thought of that just like a leaf on a tree. As we go down through the year, some of the members have passed away. And every time a member passes away, it's just like a leaf falling off a tree. Then we try to reproduce another leaf to carry on where that leaf has gone to its end of its journey. We have a motto. It says, coming together means beginning. Working together means progress. And keeping together means success. And actually, when we go out to do an event, I always try to weigh the audience to see how they think and how they feel about gospel music. And lots of time I ask, how do you like the Patriots or the Boston Celtics? Oh, they get a big role, you know. And the Red Sox. And I said, well, what about us, you know? And it just it's worked very well. And you know, one of the things I think is most interesting that see that is so many white people are suffering and looking for this type of environment. You know what I'm saying?
What's the difference between gospel and Jubilee?
Well, gospel music can be like a deep, sensational feeling.
I know I've been changed. I know I've been changed.
As compared to Jubilee, Jubilee is on a fast rhythm.
You may run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut them down. You may run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut them down.
And what we try to do, we try to keep the tradition going and not let it die. What's happening out there, they are trying to push the real traditional original things in the gospel field, of, you know, trying to push it aside and cover it up with all of this other rhythm and stuff that they're trying to do, and lots of it ain't worth a quarter for as I'm concerned, you know, it doesn't do nothing for the public.
Run long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time, let me tell you, God Almighty gonna put them down.
And one of the things that is so, that makes, I would say, makes such a difference with us, see, we sing with our music.
Run and hide, try to slip and.
If it's good, it's good. If it's bad, it's bad. You can hear what everybody is more or less saying or doing. Well, now, in the churches, the ministers of music, the pianists and the organists, some of them play so loud until they drown out the real words of the song. And it's more to it than just rhythm. You know what I'm saying?
What's the heart of your music?
Well, the heart of our music is being able to reach the people with a spiritual touch that they can feel something within.
Lord, such a beautiful city. Oh, oh, that a beautiful city. I can see my Savior standing there.
And have something to take home with them.
Something direct without the need for instruments, even.
Something to lift up their spiritual, everyday walk and environment.
Hello, John, city song. The city, big plus, the city was a whole square wide. You know, he looked again, you know, he studied himself. He saw my Jesus on the other side.
Do you think this type of music will survive?
Well, that's a good question. And that remains to be seen, because a lot of the younger people in the group don't have too much of remembrance about the, you know, older numbers and things of that nature, because some of them just think of the, you know, the stuff that's out there now. And it's not really that deep dedication member there who thinks like I think. So I'm the only one that really keeps that alive.
When God is
made by my God's hand.
I'm still hanging in there, and like I said, the Lord has much more for me to do. As I always say, he ain't through with me yet.
Three gates open over there. I got my religion and I won't be late.
Deacon Randy Green of the Silver Leaf Gospel Singers of Roxbury, Massachusetts. Our piece was produced by Lynn Menegon. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
And Franklin Newton's gonna ask my Lord for my shoe, because you see, I'm Jerusalem.
When God is
made by my God's hand.
Hallelujah, now
you better join the band.
My brother, get ready
for the. Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.